This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, red flags, Australian universities doing multi-million dollar deals with Chinese surveillance companies and crushing workloads, chronic understaffing. The Aged Care Royal Commission turns its attention to the pressures on the workers caring for the elderly.
If you're one carer to 10 residents and you've got buzzers going, you're on a time limit. A lot of the times we'd say, oh, I'll be back shortly, but we'd never get back there.
The big banks thumb their noses at requests to pass on the Reserve Bank's recent cut in official interest rates in full to home borrowers. So now the Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg's ordered the consumer watchdog, the ACCC, to investigate how the sector prices loans and how much customers are being ripped off. But that report won't deliver quick relief. It's not due until September next year. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has more.
There have been three cuts to official interest rates this year alone. They're now at a record low of 0.75%, but the cuts aren't being passed on in full to many customers.
The Australian public are sick and tired of the merry dance where the RBA has cut rates three times in recent months. The government and the RBA itself have called on the banks to pass them on, and the banks have just ignored that advice and that call.
It's why Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has today announced that the consumer watchdog, the ACCC, will conduct an inquiry into the banks that will look at what interest rates are being offered to customers.
Well, we need all the information at hand about the cost of funds of the banks, about the difference between what they charge existing customers and new customers, and in terms of why they are not passing on these rate cuts in full after the RBA has said that their cost of funds have come down significantly and they should be passed on.
The investigation will also examine the barriers preventing people from switching lenders to find a better deal.
And if the big four banks had passed on these 75 basis point rate cuts, then somebody with a $400,000 mortgage would be more than $500 a year better off in lower interest payments.
Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers says extra money in people's pockets would help the economy.
We want to make sure that those interest rates cuts can do good in the economy. That means having them passed on to consumers so they've got more disposable income to spend in our shops and businesses.
He's welcoming the government's announcement.
Labor's been calling for the ACCC to play a bigger role here, so we welcome this step in principle, but we'll work through the detail.
The inquiry will look at all banks and non-bank lenders, but the big four banks will be the focus as they hold about 75% of residential mortgage debt. Josh Frydenberg said he reached out to the bank bosses yesterday.
I actually did call the CEOs of the big four banks and told them that this could actually help clear the air and that this was an opportunity for them to explain to the regulator why they haven't been passing on the rate cuts on in full.
The ACCC will produce a final report by September next year. It will then be up to the government to decide what recommendations it introduces, meaning customers might not see any change until 2021. Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers is urging a quick response.
Well, we need to see the benefits of any ACCC inquiry flow through to customers as soon as possible.
The Australian Banking Association, which represents 23 banks, says it's reviewing the proposal and will cooperate with the inquiry.
Stephanie Boris reporting there. The Federal Parliament resumes today. The House of Representatives now has only four sitting weeks for the rest of the year. The Attorney General, Christian Porter, is also Manager of Government Business in the House, and he joins us now. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Morning, Sabra.
You were determined to legislate religious discrimination by the end of this year. Given the feedback that you've had, how realistic is that?
Oh, I think we'll certainly have a bill that'll be introduced and part debated. I think also it's clear from the consultation process that there'll be a committee process inside Parliament, and that'll also be a fairly heavy and contested space. So I would say definitely introduction. I think we'll get quite a distance through the debate. I wouldn't be perfectly sure about full passage, but you know, you set targets and goals and you push towards them.
All right. And I know from your talking points that have been accidentally emailed around Parliament this morning that you're going to hold some roundtables next week. Firstly, how embarrassing is it that your talking points are out there?
Well, I didn't know that they were, but I mean, these things happen from time to time. And in any event, there'll be invitations out to those consultations. So it's not really like it's a big secret, Sabra.
And will you genuinely take on board feedback, or is this just a tick the box exercise?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I've consulted with over 90 groups in multiple sessions, each of the sessions going for 2 hours, many more than that. And it's not like we pretended that every piece of drafting and use of words in the legislation in its draft form was completely perfect. We've learnt quite a bit on the way through, and we said, say for instance, from the beginning that it was difficult for us without the expertise to understand how religious aged care and hospitals work and what might be their requirements. So we've had special sessions with them. So yeah, I mean, there'll be changes, but they're not changes at the margin, nor are they massive or substantial changes. And
are you reading all the submissions yourself?
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, look, a lot of the submissions, there were, you know, 10,000 submissions, which are a pro forma half-page email, but the serious and substantive submissions, of course, I read. And I think, look, there's been three views that have emerged. Big business don't want to have any limitation whatsoever to their ability to control what their employees do. Religious and faith groups are generally pleased with the protection that having religion as an attribute would offer, but they'd probably go further in giving themselves greater autonomy around employment of staff. And I think the third thing is LGBTI groups would go further again another way around further limiting people's ability to say things in accordance with their religion, even if those things aren't malicious or said in bad faith. But this is a balancing process, trying to make sure that all three of those things are as accommodated as they possibly can be, but not everyone's going to be perfectly happy. That's the nature of this type of legislation.
Yeah, well, how are you going to find a middle ground here? Because both secular and religious groups are deeply unhappy with what you've proposed, and you've got the Uniting Church also saying that it fears that this might open up discrimination against vulnerable groups. Where are you going to find the middle ground that keeps everybody happy?
Well, deeply unhappy is your take on it. I mean, my view is that the religious groups, largely speaking, want this protection. They think the fundamentals of the bill are sound. They want more in some areas and less in other areas. LGBTI groups want more restriction of speech and less protection for religion in other areas, and big business have got their own view. But it's a balancing exercise. And the idea that everyone's going to be sort of marching in the streets with placards congratulating the government on the bill, I think, is not where we're going to end up. But that doesn't mean that there won't be a passage and a pathway through Parliament.
But you might
and ultimately an improvement for people's protection of their religious rights to express themselves.
You might say that. You've got people like Rex Patrick who's saying he's yet to be convinced that there's a problem that needs fixing.
Well, I've found with Rex, with all due respect, he's yet to be convinced until ultimately he gets convinced. And that's a process, right, with the crossbench. But I mean, for people like Rex, I'd be sitting down and saying, you know, well, last year there was a head of a senior Jewish organisation in New South Wales refused entry to an invited function in New South Wales Parliament House. And that's totally lawful in New South Wales. But had he been refused on the basis of the fact that he might have had a disability or because of his sex or gender or age, that wouldn't be lawful. And the fundamental thing here is that there is a need to ensure that people's religious belief doesn't exclude them and doesn't form the basis of discrimination against them.
The government was hoping to reveal the Medivac bill this week, or the laws this week. Jackie Lambie says that she won't be horse trading over this bill. Will you persist?
Absolutely. I mean, look, our position on these sort of matters, I think, is accepted by Middle Australia. It's rejected by some, but it's absolutely crystal clear.
So Jackie Lambie's not voicing concerns of Middle Australia?
No, I don't believe that she is. I mean, we took our vision as to how border protection should work and our track record as to how border protection should work to a full election, and it was fully endorsed. And part of that was retaining the orderly system of medical transfers that successfully worked to date, where the minister does have an ultimate discretion. Now, there's a simple matter of principle which we think is fundamental to our border protection, fully endorsed in election, and we will be absolutely crystal clear that that's our position. The opposition have got multiple views on this, multiple views on energy policy, on environmental policy, on tax. They've reached a space where you can't actually tell what their position is, but everyone knows what our position is.
All right. Four Corners is putting the spotlight on the university sector and foreign interference tonight. The government set up an investigation into interference in universities. Is this all too late? Will we ever gain full knowledge of how much research has gone offshore, and will we be able to unmask all of those working covertly for foreign actors?
Well, I haven't seen, obviously, the show yet. I'll be watching it with enormous interest. I think the first point to make is that as a government, we have greatly strengthened and pushed enormous resilience into the ability of us as a society and as a government to respond to foreign interference and influence. Major rewrites of the law last year. Universities are a not insubstantial part of that, but they are autonomous organisations, and we have to work in cooperation with them, and they need to make themselves very hard targets for this sort of behaviour. And we've seen with New South Wales ICAC and the money flowing into the Labor Party there, that Australia has a diverse variety of mechanisms to uncover this type of undue interference and influence of particularly foreign money, but also efforts to influence Australian public policy or to elicit information that would otherwise be kept at arm's length from foreign principals. So universities have got to take a deal of responsibility for themselves, and Dan Tehan and the Minister has been working with them on this. But I think that there's a fairly large amount of work that would remain to be done in this space.
Attorney General Christian Porter, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thank you.
And as just mentioned, a joint Four Corners background briefing investigation has found Australia's top universities are engaged in multi-million dollar deals with Chinese entities involved in Beijing's surveillance state. Some of those companies have been blacklisted by the United States government in the past week after being implicated in human rights abuses. The federal government recently announced a university's foreign interference task force, which we just touched on, and experts warn research partnerships like these could be a risk to national security. Mario Christodoulou reports.
The Chinese government runs one of the most sophisticated surveillance states in the world, using technology like this.
Meet the eyes of the machine. McVee
is a high-tech Chinese startup specialising in powerful surveillance technology. Last week, the US government added the company to its trade blacklist, concluding it was implicated in the repression of China's Muslim minorities. Here in Australia, McVee has worked with academics from the University of Adelaide who helped refine its facial and vehicle recognition technology. McVee is not alone. Here's Professor John Fitzgerald from Swinburne University.
Australia's science and technology priorities are being set by the Chinese government because we enter into collaborations that have really been designed to support China's science and technology goals, not ours.
The University of Adelaide has told Four Corners and Background Briefing its work with McVee wasn't a formal collaboration. McVee says it tries to ensure its technology isn't used for human rights violations. The US government has also blacklisted Chinese video surveillance company SenseTime over human rights abuses. SenseTime has worked with academics from the University of Sydney to develop tech that tracks people through multiple video frames. The company says its collaboration was purely focused on academic research. Meanwhile, the Australian National University in Canberra has worked with a Chinese defence university on covert communications technology. UTS have worked on projects with companies linked to the surveillance of Uyghurs. Alex Joski is from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
It's clearly not in Australia's interest to be recklessly training scientists who will go on to develop technologies that could be used against our military and against our country.
Katrina Jackson, the Chief Executive of Universities Australia, describes research collaborations as complex.
If we stop conducting collaborative research, we will create no new knowledge. I'm not saying these are simple issues, but universities are absolutely diligent in making sure they comply with the laws the way they are.
Sydney University says the partnership is subject to ongoing review, and ANU says it is constantly evaluating what is acceptable to work on with different groups. UTS is abandoning projects with a Chinese state-owned military company after concerns were raised by Australia's Defence Department.
Mario Christodoulou reporting, and you can see that investigation on Four Corners on ABC TV tonight at 8:30, or download the background briefing episode wherever you get your podcasts from. At least 30 people have died and 18 people are still missing after a powerful typhoon caused major flooding and landslides across Japan. The storm swept through the country, bursting more than 20 riverbanks in 24 places, and at least 140 other rivers have overflowed. Many residents are now being forced to confront the massive cleanup. Our North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports from Kawasaki, southwest of Tokyo.
The hum of generators pumping thousands of litres of water makes for a numbing backdrop to the cleanup here in the low-lying streets of Kawasaki. The leftover water means many residents still can't go back home and see the damage. One man in his 60s died around here, trapped as rising floodwaters engulfed his ground floor apartment. Haruo Ishizuka says the water level near his house went up to 4 or 5 metres. He says he never imagined it would be this bad. The forecast said 400 millimetres of rain, but it suddenly went to 500 millimetres. He says it felt dangerous and now the aftermath is terrible. More than 110,000 officials are involved in rescue operations and many are concentrated in the Nagano Prefecture in central Japan. Authorities spent the day evacuating hundreds from their homes, trapped by the rapidly rising floodwaters. Much of the worst flooding has been in this prefecture. This local says she saw everything in her house getting washed away and thought, is this a dream or reality? But she says she's very glad she survived. Tragically, a 77-year-old woman died when authorities did not attach her harness correctly to an evacuation helicopter. The full extent of the devastation is yet to be revealed, with floodwaters yet to recede across many parts of the country. But there is some cause for optimism. Last night, Japan defeated Scotland in the Rugby World Cup to secure a place in the quarterfinals. The heavy rains from the typhoon had threatened to force the game's cancellation. It's the best result in a World Cup for the team, nicknamed the Brave Blossoms, and Japan's victory is sure to be a source of inspiration during this difficult time. This is Jake Sturmer in Kawasaki, reporting for AM.
The United States has announced it's withdrawing its forces from northern Syria to make way for Turkey's offensive against Kurdish forces. But the Kurds have made a deal to let Syria's government take over the cities under its control in a bid to stop the Turkish advance. Middle East correspondent Eric Torcek reports from the Turkey-Syria border.
As Turkey advances, the United States is pulling back. Defence Secretary Mark Esper explains why to US network CBS.
We also have learned in the last 24 hours that the Kurdish forces are looking to cut a deal, if you will, with the Syrians and the Russians to counterattack against the Turks in the north. And so we find ourselves as we have American forces likely caught between two opposing advancing armies, and it's a very untenable situation.
Syrian state television announced that government forces were moving into the town of Manbij as Kurdish troops withdraw. The main leadership of the armed forces announced that a few brigades of the Syrian Arab Army have entered Manbij, he says, and they've raised the flag of the Syrian Arab Republic. The deal appears to cede control of a large part of northern Syria to the government of President Bashar al-Assad. It sets up a confrontation between Turkish forces and their Syrian rebel allies with Syrian government troops. And then there's the question of the Islamic State prisoners being held by the Kurds. Former US Defense Secretary James Mattis says the instability is creating the conditions for a return of the Islamic State terrorist group.
ISIS is not defeated. We have got to keep the pressure on ISIS so they don't recover. We may want a war over. We may even declare it over. You can pull your troops out, as President Obama learned the hard way, out of Iraq. But the enemy gets a vote, we say in the military. And in this case, if we don't keep the pressure on, then ISIS will resurge. It's absolutely a given that they will come back.
Kurdish forces say hundreds of Islamic State supporters escaped from a jail, taking advantage of Turkish attacks. The conflict's already created a humanitarian crisis. Reem Nada from the World Food Programme says a growing number of people are being forced to flee.
The numbers are increasing. 130,000 people are already on the move. And we expect this number to continue to increase as the military clashes continue to escalate, as we see from people fleeing their homes and towns into Al-Hasakeh and Araqa areas.
Turkey's also facing new allegations its troops have killed civilians. A number of people, including some journalists, were reported killed by an airstrike on a mixed convoy of Kurdish fighters and civilians travelling to the city of Ras Al Ain. It follows allegations Turkish-backed Syrian rebels executed prisoners, including a female politician, over the weekend. Many people remain in harm's way, except now they're caught between the Turkish advance and the Syrian government, which is accused of multiple war crimes throughout the civil war. From the Turkey-Syria border, this is Eric Torcek reporting for AM.
Nine out of 10 workers in the residential and aged care sector say they're too stretched to offer appropriate care to their patients. That finding comes from a survey of aged care workers right around the country. And coincidentally, the Aged Care Royal Commission will begin an investigation today into the sector's workforce. But the unions representing workers say the sector can't wait until the commission delivers its final report. They say the elderly need improvements right now. Rachel Mealy reports.
Robin Kirk worked at a residential aged care home on the New South Wales North Coast for 9 years.
If you're one carer to 10 residents and you've got buzzers going, you're on a time limit. So you have to make an excuse, you know, to leave the room. Or a lot of the times we'd say, oh, I'll be back shortly, but we'd never get back there.
She says aged care workers aren't valued. A friend who worked in a supermarket earned more money than her.
A friend of mine that works for Coles in a deli who serves us a piece of ham, who's on $27 an hour and we're getting $23.60 or something. We have people's lives in our hands. You know, he's got a piece of ham in his. He puts it on a scale and he wraps it up and he gives it to you.
The Health Services Union commissioned a survey of 5,000 aged care workers across the country, asking about their daily tasks and workloads. It reveals a picture of unhappy and stressed workers who feel they can't properly look after the patients in their care. National President Gerard Hayes says older people deserve better.
Oh, these are our loved ones. These are people who have cared for us, and we should be caring for them. It's that simple.
87% of workers said they often have to hurry elderly people in order to get through their daily tasks. More than 90% said they don't have enough time to talk to residents in their care.
Clearly, such a big sample of the aged care workforce who have responded, saying that there are problems in a whole range of different areas of the workforce. It has to be saying that what we have been saying is just not anecdotal, it's actually fact.
And as demand for aged care grows rapidly, the survey warns of looming staff shortages, with 4 in 10 workers planning to leave in the next 5 years.
We firmly believe that the government has got to take steps now, not just wait for the Royal Commission, but steps now to be able to enhance the quality of care to people who actually brought this country to where it currently is today.
Patricia Sparrow is the CEO of Aged and Community Services Australia, which represents the not-for-profit aged care providers.
It is an industry under stress. It's under pressure, and that means workers are under pressure, and that's why the Royal Commission's important, and that's why we're saying we want to move on this and be able to address the issues and employ more staff.
Last year, a Productivity Commission report predicted workforce numbers will need to almost triple to 1 million in order to meet demand. In response, the federal government is now implementing its own aged care workforce strategy.
Rachel Mealy reporting. In the midst of one of the country's worst droughts, councils in New South Wales are urging state and federal governments to come up with a long-term water security strategy. It'll be one of the main talking points as council representatives from across the state meet in Sydney this week, as David Sparks reports.
A $1 billion package to upgrade or build new dams is welcome news in much of drought-hit New South Wales. But local councils still want a water strategy that runs much deeper. Daria Turley is the mayor of Broken Hill.
We just want to say to them, it's not dams alone that's going to save this. We do have to have big picture. It isn't just about the farmer, although that's important, but it is also about the flow and effects to all our small businesses, including our sporting ovals and sporting facilities. Let's have a big plan and let's start thinking strategically.
The Federal and New South Wales governments are promising to spend $650 million to upgrade the Wyangala Dam in the state's central west, while $480 million will go to the new Dungowan Dam near Tamworth. But at this week's Local Government Association conference, mayors and general managers will have on their agenda a call for the New South Wales government to develop a 30 to 40 year water supply strategy.
We need to look how we do adapt. Every one of our councils, they will put up ideas and proposals of what will be included in that 30-year strategy.
The Berkshire Council is thinking big. It wants ambitious projects on the scale of the Snowy Mountains scheme to be on the table. Ross Earle is the council's general manager.
As the motion from the LG New South Wales board suggests, we need that 30 or 40-year strategy to make sure we actually drought-proof rural New South Wales as best we can and ensure both there's water for agriculture, but certainly security of town water as well, which is critical. But what we're looking at is any solution which will give us that long-term security. If that's a series of smaller dams, that'd be tremendous.
The Orange City Council has a few ideas. It built a stormwater harvesting system 10 years ago, trapping water from around the city, treating it, and then supplying it to local households. Mayor Reg Kidd says it's a handy boost to the town's water supply.
Just recently we had 10 mil of rain. That's not much. It wouldn't have wet your garden. But from that 10 mil of rain, we were able to get nearly 2 weeks' water.
Households have also changed the way they use water.
And that's been through community engagement and education on water, using your water more wisely, if you like. Here's a good one. Ask your friends, do you have any idea how much potable water per person the average is in Sydney? I'll bet you they can't tell you.
What is it?
About 220, 240. In Orange, we're 140 litres per person per day.
Whatever the method, Broken Hill Mayor Daria Turley says now's the time to prepare for the droughts that will inevitably come in the decades ahead.
We want the government to actually fix up those issues so when it does rain, that, you know, we don't have to have a cycle that in another 20 years that the communities are listening to the same story.
That's Broken Hill Mayor Daria Turley ending that report from David Sparks. The drought across much of the country has meant it's been an extremely challenging time for farmers. But Australia's peak farming body is confident the industry can be worth $100 billion in little more than a decade. It's currently worth $60 billion. And today, the National Farmers Federation will release a report card in Canberra to mark its progress. Here's National Rural Reporter Kath Sullivan.
Business is booming at Kate Sutherland's Tasmanian farm.
We've got 47 hectares under protected cropping at the moment, split about 50-50 between strawberries and raspberries. And I think we'll be packing about 7 million punnets this year.
If you shop at Coles, Aldi or Woolies, there's a good chance that one of those punnets could end up in your trolley. Harvest kicks off on the farm at Cressy outside of Launceston in a couple of weeks. And with the help of 600 workers, will run through until the end of May. Kate Sutherland says that her business has been able to grow with the help of an understanding bank manager and the right climate.
We are in the right place at the right time, and supermarkets need to be able to provide product, you know, all year round. So in the winter, most of the berries are grown further north in Queensland and northern New South Wales. But in the summer when it's hot, you have to be growing it somewhere cooler, where Tasmania fits perfectly into that season.
This is one of 85,000 farming businesses in Australia and part of an industry worth $59 billion. The National Farmers Federation wants agriculture to be a $100 billion industry by the year 2030.
Yeah, it's a fair increase, but we think we're capable of getting there.
That's NFF Chief Executive Tony Marr. He might be optimistic, but a report card he'll release today shows Australian agriculture is on track to fall short of that goal by about $16 billion.
So there's been some real tailwinds around trade agreements, around measures to engage with the community, but there's been some headwinds as well, and that is obviously drought, water policy, climate change policy. So these are some of the challenges that we as an industry will continue to deal with and contend with.
Of all of those challenges, drought is the overwhelming concern.
Clearly we're in uncharted waters in relation to this drought. So we have internally been developing our national drought policy, and hopefully we'll finalise that on Wednesday. But this has to be a partnership. It has to be industry. Industry's got roles and responsibilities, but clearly so does government, and that means Commonwealth government, state government and local government.
While Kate Sutherland's patch of Australia is for now untouched by the drought, she's all too aware of how important water is to the farming sector.
It depends on the commodity, obviously, and it's all based on climate and water availability. We went to the Netherlands last year, and they're the second largest exporter of agricultural produce in the world from one of the smallest countries. They have excellent use of their water.
Get that right, and the opportunities will flow.
It's interesting. We have all four of our daughters are now joined us in the business because they can see the opportunities as young people in horticulture. So we're very excited about that.
That's Farmer Kate Sutherland, ending that report by Kath Sullivan. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The Chinese government loves to keep a close eye on its citizens, and it's getting better tech to do that all the time. But some Chinese students living in Australia don't want to be seen.
Today's episode is about how China watches its people, even in Australia, and the Australian scientists helping them do it. That's The Signal, every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.